Thank you for joining us for this episode. Today, we're joined by Ahmad Fahmy, and we're going to be speaking about the sensitivity of the cornea on the OI show. Friends, this is Dave Keating. Before we get into the show, I wanted to thank Team for supporting the podcast. If you're not aware, Team is a virtual staffing and agency which helps connect virtual teams to your practice. I don't know about you, but I had a harder and harder time finding people to come in and join me in the in-office staff. And so over the last 2 years, we've found 10 virtual people to become part of our team. They do things like answer the phone, they help with billing insurance, they check for documentation before it comes in, they scribe in the exam room, they can order contact lenses, and the list goes on. We've been able to work with several agencies over the years, but we have found that Team has been the most effective at ensuring that our virtual employees get paid, stay on time, and that we're following up with them and making sure that they're a great agency for these people. If you are ever interested in considering a virtual employee into your office, I'd love to chat with you. But also, I wanted to let you know that Team is offering a $250 discount when you first sign up with them. Check out hireteam.com, hireteam.com for a $250 discount, or see the show notes below for a link that will get you to the website. Thanks to Team for supporting the OI show, and thanks to you for being a listener. Well, thanks again for joining us. I'm so stoked to have you with me, Ahmad. Thanks for coming on and hanging out with me. How are you doing, buddy?
Awesome. Yeah, thanks so much for allowing me to be a part of the show, and looking forward to it.
Yeah. So most people know you, but why don't you give us a little bit of an introduction of what you're doing, what your clinic looks like, you know, what your week or month looks like?
So I'm in clinical practice here at Minnesota Eye Consultants. It's an MD-OD practice. I've been here for the majority of my career. Love doing high quality education, and so I I'm a founder of the Twin Cities OSD Symposium, which is here in Minnesota, and a co-founder of Eyes on Dry Eye. So I have a special interest in ocular surface disease, glaucoma, perioperative care, and so I've really enjoyed working in this clinical practice where we have pretty good scope, it's just fun to be able to do things like this. So
yeah. Well, I know you guys just somewhat recently had the Minnesota meeting, and it's just a killer meeting. I looked at the itinerary; it was awesome. So we'll make sure that people look out for that. Where can they find more information about coming in the years to come?
Yeah, thanks. It's September 7th and 8th, 2024, and it's TwinCitiesOSD.com. And so we're really looking at expanding the workshops and doing more hands-on education, in addition to kind of just getting experts up there and debating things and looking deeper into why some folks are still refractory to sort of what we might be treating them with initially.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of that, you know, a sexy topic that I think that you and I both care a lot about, and until we are brought this back to our attention, we tend to ignore it. And that's the sensitivity of the cornea. I remember it was about 10 years ago, I bought my Cochet-Bonnet anesthesiometer, and we started using it on patients, and we were just surprised at how often. But then I just kind of quit using it because I didn't really know what to do with that information. So talk to us a little bit about how you are becoming more and more aware of this, and how you see this in clinic, and how you test for it, and just kind of give us a little bit of an overview of corneal sensitivity.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you, Dave. I mean, I also was just kind of like doing it sparingly, probably 5 years ago, 6 years ago. But the more we really study this condition, the more we, see that it's probably kind of slipping through the cracks if we're not really looking for it you know, on a daily basis. If you're seeing anybody that is a diabetic, has had multiple, you know, surgeries in the past, has had previous infection, HSV, you know, zoster, any kind of infection where there's been probably some disruption of their corneal nerves in the past, you know, all of these things are, it's important to test it and then retest it. And so I've now in the habit of just making sure that I communicate that to my staff. I want them to just make sure in the workup, we don't obviously put any drops in the eyes that are going to be, you know, any anesthetic drops before I test it. And mm-hmm. and this is where I love doing this. So I learned from you and all my other colleagues. I've been using still just a cotton wisp. And I want to ask you too, like, you know, the information I get from a cotton wisp, basically, I'm very careful to see what the patient's response is to it every time that I do it. And I have been really thinking to add a Cochet Benet. And so what's your advice to me? What's your added value from doing that?
Well, you know, if the goal is to get from zero to 100, the reality is most of us are at zero when it comes to corneal sensitivity thinking. The fact that you put something on the cornea and like think about it, I think is getting you to 90, right? But getting from the 90 to the 100 about understanding what's happening is where a Cochet Benet is, you know, is kind of a way. They're about $500. They're not going to break the bank, but, you know, $500 as far as like grading it, right? But, you know, after you've done it as many times as you've done it, you know that some patients, like, you're barely whisking it and they're like, you know, they're like, okay, I feel that, right? Well, that kind of tells you that they are very sensitive, right? And then there's other patients where you're like pushing all of the fibers of a cotton wisp on the eye and maybe even pushing with the and they don't feel anything, right? So you can kind of quantify a little bit with a cotton wisp. But what I like about the Cochet Benet is that I have a number, and that when I retest the patients after my treatment, that number may be changing, you know, somewhat similar to, you know, the variability that you and I might have in checking somebody's eye pressure. We may have a little bit of a variability, but plus or minus one or two is not going to make, you know, make or break somebody from having glaucoma. There's going to be some variability in the testing of the Cochet Benet, but having a number that you're kind of tracking, and you take somebody who's had a sensitivity, and the way the Cochet Benet works is, it's I probably should have brought that up, is it's a looks like a pen, and then it's got kind of a fiber like a fishing line that comes out from it. And when the fishing line is at its longest, it's measured at a 6. And if you poke the eye and the patient feels that, then that's normal. Now, if the patient doesn't feel it, then you bring the fiber further in, and say if you brought it all the way to the 1, then that fiber is very stiff. And if you poked the patient, they're more likely to feel it. And so having that number, and if you take a patient from, say, I have a 2, and you do a treatment on them, and now they're a 6, well, obviously something changed. You know, if they go from a 2 to 2.5, maybe there was a change, right? So that's the nice thing about the Cochet Benet, is it allows you to quantify. Mm-hmm. And they're not that expensive. I don't pull for it every single day, but there are patients where it's like, oh, you know, that cotton wisp is a little bit, they do have a problem. Maybe I want to know how much of a problem. And so then I can pull for it.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And so do you so you obviously then test and retest with that.
Yeah. You know, the difficult thing about it is in all of the studies on corneal sensitivity testing, you know, they test in 5 quadrants: centrally, superior nasal, inferior temporal, or inferior superior. In clinical practice, I don't do that, right? I look if there's an area of staining, or if there's an area where the cornea looks a little bit, I might test in that area. But just going through a complete diagnostic of every single area Because when you do use Cochet Bonnet, you're probably touching the cornea. If they do have a sensitivity, you're probably touching the cornea and dabbing on it like three times, right? So you're going like, oh yeah, they don't feel it at six. And then you don't, you know, what do you go to, a five or a four, right? So you may be tapping on the cornea quite a few times, and it just could take 2 or 3 minutes to do the entire cornea. So I just am like, hey, there's a sensitivity issue, quantify it for that area and go from there. You know, in research, we would measure the entirety of the cornea at all the different areas. And that is something that's a little quicker with a cotton wisp, as you might just be like, yep, sensitive there, not sensitive there. So there's goods and bads about both.
Yeah. Awesome.
So let's talk a little bit about this. Common causes of decreased corneal sensitivity. What are some things that you see more often in practice in your clinic?
I mean, the biggest one is previous HSV.
Right.
You know, a previous zoster. So those patients, and really anybody who kind of comes in with some asymmetry where their cornea just looks pretty, you know, compromised, their corneal epithelium is just really, you know, sort of unhealthy. And, you know, the main thing that brought them in is they're just really frustrated with their vision or variability in their vision. So, but I typically kind of have a high index of suspicion for, you know, diabetic patients and patients with
right.
HSV. I see a lot of glaucoma patients as well. And over a number of years, you know, you start to see some, if the patient is, you know, using a lot of, you know, especially multiple medications, they can be anywhere along this continuum, just as you, you know, really eloquently pointed out that it might be very regional in some patients. They might have corneal sensitivity that is different from one part of the cornea to the other. The same thing sometimes happens with, you know, glaucoma patients that just need to be on have been on a medication for many years. So, so I really try to get those folks, you know, make sure that every glaucoma patient really should be coming in for a detailed ocular surface disease assessment,
yeah.
which really should include corneal sensitivity. So,
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think with what we know about glaucoma medications, and now we've got preservative-free glaucoma medications, which is, you know, really awesome. All the surgical approaches are obviously, hopefully we're going to see less of that severe ocular surface disease in the future. But for right now, you know, another subgroup of patients in cornea where we're really focusing on is, now we've had a lot more patients who have had corneal cross-linking. That's another subgroup of patients, you know, corneal cross-linking, looking at it in that perspective. Obviously, contact lens wear can bring about, you know, neurotrophic issues. And there's a host of other ones on the list, but the ones that you and I have just mentioned probably make up about 80, 90% of the cases. So there are other things, but particularly that herpetic and that diabetic patient, those are ones where if you see some stain without pain, or if you see, you know, that it's just not resolving the way that you thought, it could be something a little bit deeper and may want to go. So let's talk the easy way of doing this. How do you incorporate this into your ocular surface disease workup? And is it something you do on everybody? You know?
Yeah. I mean, if they're coming in for an OSD eval or a dry eye eval, my team knows that I want to do corneal sensitivity before they do any of the testing. So typically the workup will include imaging, osmolarity, and MMP9 testing. Mm-hmm. And so I want my technician to just basically check their vision and then come and get me on the clinic side to go into their tech room real quick and do my corneal sensitivity testing. And then I go back to my clinic side, you know, so it's not good for flow, but it's really important to do that. So, I mean, I just think you have to take that time, just like, you know, when you're doing a really high sort of specialty ocular surface disease assessment, you really have to take the time to talk to the patient. I know that you know this very well. I mean, sometimes you can be doing, you know, picking up things exactly right and picking up the, you know, devising the best treatment plan, but you have to put in the time,
yeah,
explain everything to the patient. Well, this is kind of one of those things. You just have to take the time to go and do all the testing before you put in any anesthetic or manipulate the surface at all.
You know, talking to a patient about the fact that you don't have the pain that I want you to have is a weird conversation. Tell us how you talk to patients about neurotrophic issues that they have. I mean, some of them are just completely oblivious, right? I think about Angie, the patient who I saw. She's this 85-year-old patient, and she can just never get good glasses, right? She's just always discouraged about her glasses. Her cornea looks like sandpaper, but she could care less, right? So how do you go about having some of these conversations with people?
I basically kind of talk about, I like to talk about how important the corneal epithelium is, or the skin cells, or the surface of your eye, how important it is for bending light and a tear film that is stable over the skin layer, how important that is for your vision, and how just, you know, the optics really starts with the tear film, and a healthy surface underneath it is really important for the overall quality of the vision. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes takes some convincing, that variability in the vision is not just about the refraction and the contact lens power, but so I use a lot of pictures. I like to take pictures of, you know, I stain everybody, of course, with lysamine and fluorescein staining, and I like to show them pictures of what a healthy tear film looks like and kind of what their compromised epithelium looks like. I also have, I'm lucky to have confocal microscopy here. And so sometimes,
lucky to have that. Yeah. That is awesome.
Yeah, so that's another thing that's really nice to show patients. But I, in my experience, I find that it's can be a little bit over the head of some patients. But those patients that are like engineers that come in with their list of questions, they definitely will connect with you on kind of what is a normal corneal nerve morphology, and what is one that looks like it's, you know, has a lot of beading or hyperfluorescence or neuromas or sprouting. You know, so being able to kind of talk about all these things. And again, just kind of listening to the patient's their body language, and kind of, if you feel like you're talking over their head, you're kind of just wasting your time and theirs until maybe another visit where, you know, they might, you know, open up those questions again. But I really like to take a lot of images, and I find that to be helpful.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about treatment. You know, I think Oxervate being the biggest one that we've now brought into the scheme of things. But let's talk about Oxervate in a moment. But what are some other things that you're doing for patients outside of Oxervate for treatment of neurotrophic issues?
Yeah. So I compounded medications like, you know, autologous serum and platelet-rich plasma. And then, you know, recently there's been some clinical studies that have shown topical insulin is also helpful for, again, just kind of persistent epithelial defects. And so I'm just kind of early in my experience with topical insulin, but the majority of my patients I'll use, you know, Oxervate or a platelet-rich plasma. And I like to use, you know, cryopreserved amniotic membrane too. So I find that, If a patient has like 3+ PEK and, you know, kind of a slow healing epithelium, I like to have them on some kind of compounded medication, and then also do a cryopreserved amniotic membrane. And sometimes I need to do multiple administrations of the cryopreserved amniotic membrane, but that's usually, you know, kind of my approach to it. So not just passive healing where we just put a contact lens on the eye, but using something that we know is going to really help with, you know, corneal nerve function and improve that epithelium quickly. Again, because those patients, and I know you'll agree that, you know, a lot of these patients, we used to think that, well, success in treating these patients is just getting that epithelium to heal. But if it takes a long time to get it to heal, they're going to be left with some haze, and that's going to be most of the time more central, where the vision is really going to be compromised. So I think, you know, incorporating some of these things synergistically is really important for the overall outcome.
Yeah. And when you say cryopreserved amniotic membrane, you mean Prechera.
Yep.
Yeah. And I don't know of any other one that's out there other than that. And we've attempted to explore other amniotic membrane options as well. And unfortunately, none of them work quite as well as Prechera in our clinic.
And I say unfortunately because it's far more expensive than the non cryopreserved ones. So I would agree with you. That has been the most effective. We also are doing PRP. We've had several people on the podcast talking about PRP. It's an amazing thing. We just did a lit review again yesterday with my resident. And so if you're not doing PRP or don't have access to it, I highly encourage you to consider that. Now, Oxervate, I have heard time and again from practitioners that they don't want to use Oxervate because it's just way too expensive. They've never tried it on their patients, but just way too expensive. So talk a little bit about this financial burden of putting somebody on Oxervate from your experience with patients.
So, I mean, I think so early on in my career, and it's really Oxervate and a lot of other medications early on in my career, I just kind of didn't really, I maybe didn't pay enough attention to that. But it's important to sympathize with patients, especially if you're sending in a prescription for a fairly new medication that may or not be covered. You're the one that prescribed it, and that's what the patient really remembers. And so they really think that we as clinicians might even have something to do with, you know, how much a medication costs or how much it's or how it's covered. And we have nothing to do, with that. I think over time, the folks that bring that medication to us, I think their process has definitely gotten better. I just make sure on my end to fill out all the forms, you know, properly and make sure nothing is missed on the forms. Most of the time we haven't really had any trouble getting that covered reasonably for patients. So I think the important thing for me is it's an opportunity for me to connect with the patient on, making sure that they know that I'm doing everything I can to, help them get it covered. While I, make sure that I reiterate to them what's the scientific reason that I'm asking them to use this versus the lubricating drop that they've been picking up on the counter.
Can you think of a patient who's come back and told you how expensive Oxervate has been for them? Like, are they telling you that it's, $80,000 or something?
I mean, I think early on, I've had maybe one or two, but not many over the last, probably year or so.
Yeah. And we're not supported or sponsored by Dompé in this particular arena. So I can tell you, I don't think I've had a patient pay over $1,000 for it in most cases. Now, that certainly I'm sure that there has been, but the vast majority of people, either there's an insurance coverage, which is you and I both know, there's a lot of paperwork to get a patient on Dompé, or they've been covered in some way under a foundation or something that has been able to help them. And I always like to say that and bring that up. It may be that your patient doesn't get coverage. However, the vast majority of the time, I'd rather try to get them on it and find out that it's too expensive, because most of the time that has not been the case for me. I don't know about for you. Have there been very many people that it was just outside the arena of the finances to be able to get them on it, or most of them got covered?
Yeah, I think here, especially, in my neck of the woods, the overall insurances have been covering it enough to where it's reasonable for patients and affordable for patients. Yeah.
Agreed. Well, awesome, man. I think we covered the bits of it. I know that you and I both could talk even more about this and the nuances and cases that we've had, but for the sake of time, anything that we haven't touched on that you think or you want to reiterate as to how we can better diagnose and manage patients who have corneal sensitivity decreases or issues in the ocular surface arena?
Yeah, I mean, I would just say, keep in mind, it's important to test. If your gut feeling is, well, maybe I should test this patient, definitely do it. And just remember that it's sometimes not an all or none thing. So corneal nerve function can be damaged in ways where there is hypoesthesia and then other patients that just have unusual symptoms with allodynia can also have corneal hyperalgesia. So these, and we're learning so much more about what potential treatments we might be able to offer these patients. So just, keep testing it. And that I think is really probably the most important part.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, awesome, man. I appreciate you hanging out with me on the OI show. It's always good chatting with you and great information, as always. So thanks for hanging out with me.
Awesome, man. Anytime. And I appreciate you and having a platform like this for us to just kind of talk over things. I think it's really important. So I appreciate you taking the time to do it.
Well, I don't care if anybody listens to the podcast. I learned so much just getting to hang out with my friends and learn from their clinical experience and knowledge. So thank you. And thank you for listening to the OI show. Make sure to like and subscribe. Stay tuned for future episodes. And if you could do us a favor, make sure to give us a review so that other people can learn about and hear about the OI show. Have a great day. Thanks, buddy.
Yeah, super. Of course.
That's easy. I mean, it just goes by so fast because we're just like spitballing, right? We have this internal mental clock of 50 minutes, don't we? Like, it's like a 50-minute lecture. So it does. But it just goes by so quick when we try to slam out 20 minutes. It's awesome. Yeah. Good.
I really appreciate it. That was fun. Like, and like you said,
no, thank you.
This and other things for like, I don't know, another half hour or so.
I know. Would you do me a favor? Could you send me a photo and a bio? And would you also include information about the meeting
or
anything else that you want to promote? And we'll put it in the show notes. And that way other people can hear about it.
Awesome. Yeah. I'd love to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool, buddy. Well, thank you. Have an awesome Thanksgiving. And let's stay in touch. Let me know if I can do anything for you.
Absolutely. Stay in touch. And thanks again. And I appreciate it.
Thank you, buddy. All right.
Bye. Take care. Yep.
Hey friends, I just had a great conversation with Ahmad Fahmy, and we talked about corneal sensitivity and kind of soup to nuts, everything about it and diagnosing and management. I think you're going to love learning a little bit more about corneal sensitivity from one of the most fantastic clinicians in the country. Ahmad's just a great, great guy. All right, thanks.
Thanks again, friends, for joining us for this episode. Again, thanks to Team for their support of this episode. If you're considering or have ever considered getting a virtual team member for your practice, check out hireteam.com. That's hireteem.com. Mention the OI show when signing up or hit the link below for a $250 discount off of your first month's team member.